Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for July 24th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, positive feedback on the climate from low-level clouds, detecting nuclear blasts anywhere on Earth, and mathematical models of society. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how ants may be more rational than people, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
For decades, feedbacks in the climate system involving low-level clouds have been a primary cause of uncertainty in projections of future warming. These clouds have a net cooling effect on the global climate, so if climate warming decreases low-level cloud cover, it could lead to further warming, a positive feedback. A negative feedback, or reduction in the warming, would happen if the low-level cloud cover were to increase as the climate heats up. Now, Amy Clement and Joel Norris report in a paper in this week's Science their evidence that there's a positive low-level cloud feedback, which could lead to further warming. Science's Stuart Wills spoke with Amy Clement from the University of Miami.
The big problem is trying to understand the role of clouds in climate change. Basically, we don't know at this point whether clouds contribute to the climate response to greenhouse gas forcing, which would basically accelerate warming, or whether they offset the response to greenhouse gas forcing. This is a problem that's been around actually for decades. In fact, one of the first papers I read in this field as a graduate student in the early 90s was on this problem, where people had first identified the fact that the range of warming that is projected in response to greenhouse gases is almost entirely due to cloud feedbacks. I can tell you what I mean by feedbacks, which is that CO2 alone would result in just a modest amount of warming of the Earth. The big issue is whether feedbacks in the climate system amplify or dampen the warming. Some feedbacks are fairly well known and well supported by both theory and observations and well simulated by models, and water vapor is an example. We know that as the atmosphere warms, it holds more water vapor. There's observations that indicate that water vapor has increased by an amount that's consistent with climate models, and all climate models predict about the same amount of warming due to that extra greenhouse gas water vapor. But that's not the story at all with clouds. It's not clear whether clouds will dissipate or whether cloud cover will increase as the Earth warms.
So essentially what we're dealing with here is you were looking at what the sign of the feedback was on clouds, whether it was a positive feedback that would accelerate warming or a negative feedback that would tend to put some sort of brake on warming.
Exactly.
And your work seems to have come down pretty strongly on the positive feedback side. You know, what did you do to investigate this? How did you get at this?
Well, part of the issue with clouds is that besides the fact that they're not resolved in climate models, and that's a big problem unto itself, but part of the problem is that their long-term cloud records have serious problems with respect to trends. The main records of clouds that we have come from either satellites or surface-based observers. And the observations that we used in particular come from marine observations, which are made on ships of opportunity that voluntarily make observations and report them to a central office. Both of these data sets have serious problems. Satellites have the problem that they tend to be replaced every few years, and so you have an intercalibration issue from satellite to satellite. The surface-based observers, you can imagine there's several problems you can just think of offhand. You have a sailor on the deck of a ship looking up at a cloudy sky and trying to make a quantitative estimation of how much cloud is there. It's a very subjective measurement, and it's also sparse, so there are large regions of the oceans that aren't covered. Now, if there were trends in either one of those, you would be very suspect. You would think that this is probably just some artifact. But what we did was to actually look at them together. And in the period where they overlap, there's a surprising degree of agreement, and that's what we focused on in the paper. The other thing that we added to this was meteorological data in order to provide sort of a physical framework for interpreting the cloud changes. So basically, we have a whole swath of independent data sets, and together, they're telling a physically consistent story.
And what is that story that they're telling?
Well, the agreement between the surface-based and the satellite observations is, to me, almost the most interesting part of it, which is the fact that a sailor making an observation is seeing basically the same thing as a satellite, which is retrieving, you know, a number based on reflectivity and then using an algorithm to translate it into a cloud fraction. And not only are the types of measurements so different, but also the signals are pretty subtle, as with any climate change signal. They're subtle relative to, you know, what's happening from day to day and month to month. And weather kind of swamps all of our climate signals, and we have to look for these little signals in what are basically noisy measurements. What the two data sets together showed us, along with the meteorological data too, is that when the surface of the ocean is warm, these low-level clouds that we've been focusing on dissipate, and the atmospheric circulation is weaker. So all of these changes go together with well-known climate shifts that actually span the entire Pacific Basin. So the whole Pacific Basin is basically experiencing this weakening and strengthening of the atmospheric circulation. And in the stratus regions, which are in the eastern part of the subtropical oceans, there's a big response in both the cloud and the surface temperature.
And I guess you also compared those data with some of the major climate simulations out there.
Yeah, so what we did was we took these relationships that were based on the cloud data sets and the meteorological observations, and we looked to see whether the models could reproduce these relationships between clouds, temperature, and circulation. And what we found was of the 18 models that we used, so these are the models that are used in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assessment reports, what we found was that only one of the models actually reproduced the observed relationships between cloud circulation and temperature. And that was the UK Met Office Hadley Center model. This model has the highest climate sensitivity reported in the IPCC 2007 report. It projects a 4.4 degrees Celsius warming for doubling of CO2, which is the highest reported.
But I suppose that one objection that might be made to this is that this is a regional study, or you're covering the Northeast Pacific, and climate change is a global phenomenon. How would you respond to an objection like that?
That's a very good point. First of all, the reason why we chose the Northeast Pacific was because this is a region that's had a lot of ship traffic over basically the last half of the 20th century. And so it's a place where we can feel confident that there's enough surface observations that we can really compare them against the satellite data. But the relationship between Northeast Pacific and global climate, there is a relationship there. And that's where the circulation link comes in. The changes in the Northeast Pacific are tied to changes that span the entire Pacific Basin, which, after all, is about half the surface of the Earth. And when the atmospheric circulation over the Pacific weakens, we have cloud changes in the Northeast Pacific. We have a reduction in the cloud cover there. And this is also paralleled by what's happening in the Southeast Pacific, which is also a stratus region. So what's happening here, even though it's not happening in the same way over the entire globe, does represent a large fraction of the variance in global cloud cover.
So we have at the very least a Pacific-wide phenomenon that is likely to be swinging a pretty heavy hammer in global climate.
Yes, that's an excellent way to say it.
So I wonder if we could just close by talking a bit about the implications of this study. I mean, when people talk about positive feedbacks in climate, they tend to, you know, move on to talk about tipping points and nonlinear effects that can really start to drive the system in a rapid way. What do you think are, you know, sort of in the framework of the more general discussion of climate change, what do you think is the main takeaway of this study?
Well, I think there's sort of a two-part takeaway. One is that relying on one model is, to quote one of the reviewers of the paper, actually, it's a shaky platform. We get more confidence in simulated climate change by climate models when we have more and more models that are doing the same thing. And so what I think one takeaway message is that it's clear that more work needs to be done in trying to provide a better simulation of these clouds. And it is being done. But I think that we have to acknowledge the fact that, you know, there's a wide range of predicted warmings for the 21st century, and this study doesn't tell us which trajectory we're on. It does indicate that perhaps we should be giving serious consideration to the high end, the high range of future warming.
Amy Clement, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
That was corresponding author Amy Clement from the University of Miami talking with scientist Stuart Wills about observational and model evidence for positive low-level cloud feedback. The U.S. Congress and Obama administration continue to grapple over how to create a regulatory pathway for generic versions of biologic drugs. Here with more about it is Science Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel.
Biologic drugs are made with living material and can be much more complex and expensive to produce than chemical pills. Current U.S. laws do not provide a pathway for the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, which regulates generic chemical drugs, to regulate generic biologics. But Congress and the Obama administration want to see that change. The question right now is how long the period of exclusivity should be. That is, how long a brand-name biotech is protected from generic competition. Brand-name biotech companies see a long exclusivity period as a necessary incentive for investing in research and development. Advocates of a shorter time period frame the issue as one of competition and access to cheaper drugs. House legislators are shopping two bills, one with a 5-year period friendly to generic drug makers, and one with a 12-year period more agreeable to brand-name companies. The Obama administration favors a shorter time period and has called 7 years a generous compromise. But the Senate just passed a measure with the 12-year figure as part of its larger healthcare reform efforts. The commissioner of the FDA, Margaret Hamburg, announced that her agency plans to work on approaches to biologics with regulatory counterparts in Europe, where competition from generic biologics is already allowed.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Researchers say that a nearly complete network with over 300 stations around the world reliably detects nuclear explosions even when countries are trying to hide them. The system came about because of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, adopted in 1996 by the United Nations General Assembly, signed by 181 countries, but still not in full effect. Critics of the treaty have argued that the monitoring network would not be sensitive enough to detect cheating or clandestine nuclear tests. But as news writer Dan Cleary reports in this week's issue, the network has proven its worth in detecting signals of nuclear explosions from North Korea, both in 2006 and this past May. Science's Stuart Wills spoke with Cleary from his office in England about whether monitoring can put an end to nuclear tests.
Well, it's about the system for detecting whether countries around the world are carrying out nuclear tests, because at the moment, most countries don't carry them out because there was an agreement in 1996 to ban all tests. And most countries of the world adhere to that, although even though the treaty isn't yet in force. But the treaty is setting up a network of stations which are designed to detect cheats. So it is there to find out whether people are secretly doing tests. And, you know, that was a very real issue just a month or so ago when North Korea carried out a second nuclear test, and the network picked it up straight away. But, you know, that test and the activities of North Korea are really highlighting the need for this system.
That's a kind of interesting story in a way, because there is, as you say, this rather substantial testing apparatus that's been built up, that's even been used. But as you also suggested, the treaty technically isn't even actually in force.
That's right. It was set up in 1996. But the people who negotiated at the countries said that it couldn't come into force until all of the countries that had nuclear weapons at that time or had reactors, whether for power or for research, once they had signed the treaty and then ratified the treaty, which is, you know, they have a parliamentary vote or something like that to legally bind them to the treaty. Once that is done by all of those nuclear countries, there are 44 of them, then after 6 months, the treaty comes into force and all of the countries who have signed it are bound not to carry out any more tests. So far, 181 countries have signed the treaty and 148 have ratified it. So it's quite close to coverage, you know, universal coverage of the world. But there are 9 of these 44 states that haven't yet ratified it. And they have to be persuaded to come on board before the treaty comes into force.
And one of those nine states is the U.S.
That's true, yes. The U.S. has signed the treaty, but when it was presented by the Clinton administration to Congress to give their approval for ratification, the Senate had a vote and voted against. And as a result, the treaty has sort of been in a state of limbo for the last 10 years.
And yet still there's this worldwide testing network around this treaty. You know, what does that actually consist of?
Well, it consists of 337 monitoring stations, which are scattered throughout 89 countries of the world. So they're quite an even coverage over the whole globe. And just over half of them are seismic monitoring stations. So they're, you know, listening out for tremors in the earth from an underground test, because, you know, for the last half century, most tests have been carried out underground. So they're very delicate seismometers, and they're all connected via satellite to the treaty's headquarters in Vienna. So every day they send data back, the computers in Vienna crunch it, and they produce reports, which then go to all the signatory countries, just telling them what they've picked up. And obviously they flag up anything that looks like it could be a test. But most of the time, what it picks up are minor earthquakes, mine explosions, things like that.
Must be kind of difficult to tell them apart.
It is very difficult, but they have quite sophisticated methods for doing so. They're employing a lot of data mining techniques, which can automatically pick out things that look suspicious, which are then looked at by a human expert. But there are a lot of events. The cutoff is about 3.5 seismic magnitude for the things that they will look at. But if you go lower than that, there are so many events, you know, minor tremors, that they couldn't analyze them all. So they only look for bigger ones, which this equates to an explosion of about 1 kiloton, which is quite a small nuclear explosion. The bomb dropped on Hiroshima was about 15 kilotons. So we're talking quite small bombs it can reliably detect.
Well, of course, not all nuclear tests would necessarily take place underground, though.
That's true. And it has three other types of stations that are also on the lookout. One of them is hydroacoustic, which are essentially microphones underwater, you know, in the deep ocean. And it listens out for sound waves going through the water. And those are for detecting underwater explosions. There are also infrasound stations. Now, infrasound is very low-frequency sound that we can't normally hear. But with a very sensitive microbarometer, you can detect these very low-frequency pressure changes. And the network is incredible. It can detect all sorts of things. It's detected several volcanic eruptions. There was a large explosion of a fuel depot near London in the UK, and stations all around Europe picked that up just from the infrasound. And the final technology is radionuclides. Now, these are radioactive atoms which are produced in the explosion. And even in underground explosions, some of them escape through cracks in the rock into the atmosphere, and then they're carried on the wind over thousands of kilometers. So these stations, which are sited all around the globe, when they detect particular isotopes that are linked to a nuclear explosion, they have climate models or weather models that they wind backwards to see whether they can link those detections to a suspected nuclear test. You know, it could be days or weeks earlier in another part of the world. And that technique, detecting radionuclides, is a very important one because it's the only one that can actually say that an explosion was nuclear. All the others can say there was an explosion and it looked a bit nuclear, but if you detect the radionuclides, then you know that it was a nuclear weapon that was tested.
Well, how well does this system actually seem to be working?
Well, as a result of a meeting that happened last month where the organization that runs the treaty invited hundreds of outside scientists to use their data, do experiments of their own, try and figure out how capable the monitoring system is. And they came back and said that it was working very well, largely. There are a few holes, but they said that in most parts of the world, it can reliably detect bombs of 1 kiloton or larger. In some areas, it can do much better than that, you know, 0.1 kiloton, particularly around known nuclear testing sites.
So it's gotten sort of a good report card from this group of scientists. Where does that leave the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty in terms of ratification?
Well, there is a new impetus to move towards ratifying it. The tests in Korea certainly added to the importance of this issue. And also the new administration, President Obama, when he was campaigning last year, he said that he was going to make an effort to persuade the Congress to ratify it. And once the U.S. does, you know, experts say that they feel other countries will follow suit. Those other eight, you know, certainly some of them may follow the U.S. lead and also ratify, though, you know, others, such as North Korea and perhaps Iran, might be harder to bring into the fold.
Dan Cleary, thanks very much.
It's a pleasure.
That was Science's Dan Cleary talking with Stuart Wills. The article on nuclear test ban monitoring appears in this week's Science.
The story is really about a kind of scientific and cultural collision between communities, with natural scientists on one side, mostly physicists, and social scientists, economists on the other side.
Science's Adrian Cho reports in this week's special section on complexity about mathematically modeling the intricate interactions between people. He joins us from his home office in Michigan.
And essentially what's happening is that people are borrowing the tools and concepts from sciences like physics and applying them to social problems and trying to get deeper insight into social dynamics and the interactions of individuals. And the approach is to treat societal problems or groups of people as so-called complex socioeconomic systems.
What are these complex socioeconomic systems?
Well, a complex socioeconomic system doesn't have a tight, strict definition in the same way that, say, an atom or a gene can be precisely defined. Rather, scientists tend to describe how they behave more than sort of define exactly what they are. So these are generally groups with a large number of individuals interacting in some way very strongly so that the group tends to organize in some way or develop some sort of overall behavior that somehow is more than just the sum of the parts. So a concrete example would be traffic. Cars on a highway, the drivers react to one another in very subtle ways that can create surprising phenomena, such as so-called phantom traffic jams, which arise for no particular reason at all. And all of a sudden, everybody finds themselves at a standstill, even though there's been no accident. And sort of the basic underlying assumption of all of this is that the interactions between people can be quantified and simplified in some way, and that at least within distinct groups, people can be treated almost like particles or atoms, the assumption being that they're all basically the same.
Are there any examples of where this kind of modeling has worked or is working on such complex socioeconomic problems?
There are a couple of concrete examples where this approach seems to be paying off quite handsomely. The first is probably traffic, as we discussed in the previous example. To a physicist, traffic looks a little bit like the flow of a fluid down a tube, with the cars playing the role of the atoms and the highway playing the role of the tube. It's a lot more complicated than the flow of a fluid through a tube because the atoms or molecules in a fluid can bounce off each other, and it actually turns out as a result that if the tube narrows, then the fluid actually speeds up as it goes through. This, of course, is exactly the opposite of what happens in traffic, whereas if a lane is closed in a highway and the highway narrows, everything slows down because the drivers are all trying very hard to avoid collisions. So it's a different phenomenon, but it has some similarities, and in the last decade or so, scientists, physicists, and others have actually been able to model the interaction between drivers to quantify how drivers react to one another. And so now traffic can be modeled in very great detail on highways in urban areas and also pedestrian, you know, on the small scale pedestrian traffic through, say, a hallway or some sort of confined passage. Crowds have been modeled, and there's now a much deeper understanding of crowd dynamics and how panic sets into crowds and how crowd flow breaks down. Another example is in epidemiology. In the 90s, there was a sort of growing awareness that the spread of disease depended on the details of the social networks that brought people together so that the disease could pass from one person to the next. And more recently, researchers are using this sort of network approach in a very practical manner to model phenomena like the spread of H1N1, which obviously depends on people traveling and the like in social contacts. And so at this conference in Zurich, there was a really fascinating talk about modeling the spread of H1N1, including the world's airline networks and the infrastructure and roadway networks, public transit in major cities. And the upshot of this particular model was that it appears that, at least at first blush, that between 30 and 60% of Australians may end up getting H1N1 by the beginning of October.
And there's scientific consensus that this kind of modeling is accurate or going to be accurate?
Well, so I think it's fair to say that this is a controversial field. The examples that we've talked about are fairly concrete. There are things that are more speculative. People are taking this approach to try to address all kinds of sociological phenomena, from, say, the emergence of social norms to, say, modeling the impact of climate change on regional conflicts, such as the Darfur conflict. Obviously, there's been a lot of effort in finance and economics by physicists to try to better understand what goes on in economic systems. And some of this work has drawn a fair amount of criticism. For example, there are a fair number of economists who think that this approach, the so-called econophysics approach, doesn't take into account enough of the details of economic reality. The econophysicists counter that the classical economic theory is at its base not very realistic and is based on assumptions that are not particularly valid. But I think it's fair to say that there are researchers in the social sciences who would accuse the natural scientists who are moving into these fields of being dilettantes and not really appreciating the subtleties of the problems that they're studying.
Now, to these economic concerns and the modeling there, are any scientists thinking that the creation of these kinds of socioeconomic models might be at odds with the way science is done? For example, with financial modeling, say, once you publish it, it pretty much becomes useless, right, on Wall Street and other financial markets. It's sort of an example of an interaction, publishing it, that causes people to change what they do.
Actually, this was a point that came up at the meeting, and it's a very good point. There was a lot of talk at this meeting about, obviously, economic bubbles, and market crashes. And there was a lot of talk about trying to predict these, and if you could predict them, exactly your point came up, right? There was talk about trying to keep a sort of scoreboard of predicting bubbles and crashes, and a lot of people pointed out that if you published a prediction that, you know, the market was in a bubble and was likely to crash, and if people took it seriously, then of course they would react in some way that would probably deflate the bubble and avoid the crash, and you would never know whether or not your prediction was in fact true because people would react to it. So that is a point that came up, especially in regards to econophysics, whether or not this kind of reaction to these predictions makes it impossible to completely objectively analyze the situation.
So in your reporting, you didn't come across anyone modeling sort of on a meta level, that is, modeling the trust in other people's models?
No. that would be a very interesting model. But it must be said, this type of work, one of the things that's really impressive about this type of work is just the sheer breadth of subjects that's being undertaken. So it's possible that there might someday be a complex systems analysis of complex systems research. I wouldn't be entirely surprised.
In your view, is this interdisciplinarity a trend that's growing and everyone should just get used to it? Or is there real important reason for these kinds of culture clashes between or among scientists in these different disciplines as they attempt to tackle problems that traditionally are outside of their domain?
Well, I think that it's fair to say that this sort of approach is likely to continue for a number of reasons. You know, one, there are some successes that researchers can build on. Two, there are just huge amounts of data now available. You know, all these websites, Facebook can be analyzed as a complex system. All these things are out there and now can be analyzed, and it strikes me as very unlikely that people will simply walk away from that. And it also strikes me that there is a premium these days on trying to push interdisciplinary research, and it seems very likely to me that people are going to continue going in this direction. I would also imagine that there will continue to be a fair amount of controversy, as in any field, especially interdisciplinary fields. Some of this work is more nuanced and detailed and careful than other efforts, and I'm sure that the efforts that are a little less careful and nuanced will continue to be roundly criticized by the experts in these other fields.
Adrian Cho, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
Science news writer Adrian Cho reports on how scientists are applying the tools of physics to analyze complex socioeconomic systems. The article is part of a special section this week on complex systems and networks. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob. Welcome back.
Thank you. So I understand that one of your stories this week is about how ants may be more rational than people. Do tell.
Well, this all has to do with how we make decisions, and it turns out humans aren't as rational at making decisions as we think we are. Let me give you the following example. Say you're out hunting for a house, Rob, and you want a house that has a really big kitchen, but that also has a really big yard. And say there's two houses on the market. One has a big yard and a small kitchen, and the other one has a big kitchen, but a small yard. Now, studies have shown that you're equally likely to choose either of those houses, so you're 50% likely to choose one house or the other, which is pretty rational because they both have things that you like and that you don't like. But now let's complicate things a little bit. Let's put a third house on the market. This third house has a really big kitchen, which you like, but it has absolutely no yard. So it's not a good house for you at all, and you wouldn't consider it. But for whatever reason, putting this third house on the market that has a big kitchen will actually make you revise your decision between those first two houses, and you're more likely to pick now the house that has the big kitchen and the small yard, even though nothing's changed. So you're making an irrational decision because you don't have any new information about these first two houses, but now all of a sudden you're preferring one of them over the other.
And ants don't?
It turns out ants are smarter than we are when it comes to making these types of decisions. And what this study is all about is researchers gave ants a very similar choice to the house choice. Ants also have very specific criteria in mind when they look for homes. And what ants are looking for is they're looking for a very small entrance and a very dark cavity. And the way ants relocate is they send out these scout worker ants. And these worker ants find, you know, various abodes. And the ants, if they like them, then they recruit more and more ants until eventually the entire colony has moved to this new home. And so what the researchers did was they created a few different types of homes for these ants. They created homes with very small openings, which the ants like, but these homes were very bright, which the ants don't like. Or they created the vice versa, larger openings, but dark homes. And when giving those two choices, just like humans, the ant colonies were about 50-50 between the two of them. But when the researchers threw in a third, fourth, or a fifth choice, say an abode that had a small opening but was extremely bright, you know, it was something the ants wouldn't like at all, the ants didn't change their decision between those first two types of homes. They were still pretty much 50-50 between those two types of homes, which suggests that even when they had all these other homes to ostensibly choose from, it didn't change their rationale for choosing between those first two homes.
Now, are we talking about ants as a collective or ants one by one, like a person deciding between homes?
Well, here's where the difference comes in between humans and ants, because when humans are making decisions, we see all these choices. We see all of the houses on the market, but individual ants don't. They only see an abode and they decide whether to move the colony into it or whether not to have the colony move into it.
So the individual ant then isn't presented with a choice. This experiment was run multiple times with multiple ant colonies.
Exactly.
So each ant colony chose either the small entrance, bright cavern, or the bigger entrance, darker cavern, and each was chosen about 50% of the time.
Exactly. And Rob, the real key here is that unlike humans, ants aren't really shopping around. They aren't going to all of these potential homes and then making a decision like humans would. And what that does is it doesn't confuse them with all of these other choices. And we humans seemingly become confused when we're confronted with too many options.
So is it really fair to say that the ants are more rational than people?
Well, I guess it's fair to say that the ants are less informed than people. But what's interesting is it turns out being less informed can actually help you make better decisions.
Okay, so what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from ants trying to find a home to birds trying to find a home, and it turns out that this next study contradicts some ideas we had about nesting sites that birds choose. There's been a lot of studies done that show that birds don't seem to like noise. They tend to avoid noisy areas, and some scientists have even blamed noise, say like noise that would come from traffic or a power plant, for declines in bird populations. But this new study says some birds not only don't mind the noise, but some birds may actually like nesting in noisy environments.
Now, by liking the noisy environments, what do you mean?
Well, Rob, what that means is that some species of birds seem to prefer nesting in locations that are noisier versus nesting in locations that are quieter. In this new study, they found more of a certain type of bird in these noisy environments versus the quiet environments. And when we're talking about noise in this study, here's the noise that the researchers were focused on.
What is that?
That is the noise of a compressor, which is associated with natural gas extraction wells. And there's a bunch of these wells in this part of northwestern New Mexico where there's a lot of plots of land. Now, not all of these wells have these compressors. And so what you have is some of these plots of land where birds nest are very close to these compressors and there's a lot of noise. And some of the plots are far away or they're close to these wells that don't have compressors and there's very little noise. And so it's an important control because some of the research that's been done before with noise affecting bird populations, it's not clear if it's the noise actually causing the problem. In other words, if you've got birds close to traffic and you're seeing declining populations, you could say, well, maybe it's the noise from the traffic, but maybe there's something else about the traffic. Maybe it's the exhaust or something else. So this is a nice controlled area these researchers found. They could really eliminate a lot of these confounding factors. And the first surprising thing they found was that there was no greater bird density in the noisy parts versus the quiet parts, about the same number of nests in both places. There was a difference in species diversity. So the quieter parts had 32 bird species in them, and the noisier parts had 21 species. But just the fact that there were any species at all in these really noisy areas indicates that there's some birds that don't mind the noise and may even prefer it. For example, mourning doves and black-headed grosbacks tended to like the quieter sites, whereas black-chinned hummingbirds and house finches tended to prefer the noisy sites.
Have researchers got any idea as to why that preference occurs?
Well, there's a lot of theories. One theory is that maybe some species of birds just don't mind the noise. You know, maybe they're just not as sensitive to it as we are. Another theory is perhaps it's actually advantageous to them in terms of predators. What the researchers found was that there was a lot less western scrub jays in these noisy areas. And scrub jays are bad for other birds because they tend to rob nests. So birds that might be trying to avoid these scrub jays would tend to nest in these noisier areas. But the strategy could also backfire, too. One of the experts in this article actually said that one of her graduate students went out to collect some sage grouse. And when she did, she played some really loud rock music. And the music actually seemed to stun the birds so much that this graduate student was able to collect them very easily. And so noise can be bad for these birds, too. And there's even one other possibility, and that is that these black-chinned hummingbirds, for example, communicate using much higher frequencies, and it's possible that these birds are just better adapted to these noisier places, and they can deal with it a lot better when they're communicating with each other for mating or whatever than birds that don't have as high frequency calls.
So the birds that have a lower frequency might not be able to hear one another.
Exactly, if they're living in these loud places.
So the species appear to seek out these noisy environments, but it could just be that they're better suited to them.
Exactly.
Okay. So last one, what's this last story about?
Well, Rob, from noise to explosions, and this last story is about exploding raindrops.
I don't imagine those make a whole lot of noise.
They actually don't make a whole lot of noise, but they're very fun to watch, and there's actually a video of one of these exploding drops on the site, so I highly encourage you to check out this story.
And why was this video made?
Well, Rob, this video was made because researchers, believe it or not, have been wondering why raindrops come in such a variety of shapes and sizes.
And they explode?
They explode. That is the answer. So one theory is a very complicated theory, and it goes something like this. When the drops of rain fall out of a cloud, there's a lot of interaction. They're smashing into each other and making larger drops, and they're smashing into each other so hard that they're exploding into all these different sizes of drops. And that's a real nightmare for physicists, because if you can just imagine the type of calculations it would take to figure out all of these millions of interactions that are going on as rain falls from a cloud. And it turns out the picture may actually be a lot lot simpler than that. And that's where the explosions come in. What researchers did is they took a very high-speed camera and they filmed a water drop falling from a great height down into an airstream. So it sort of simulated a raindrop falling out of a cloud.
So they blew air up at the raindrop.
They blew air up at the raindrop, just as if it was falling right out of the sky. And what they saw in this video was that what would happen is this drop, first of all, pancakes, as you might expect, if a lot of pressure is coming at it from the top and the bottom. But after it pancakes, it forms this parachute-like shape. And then suddenly this parachute explodes into thousands of tiny little droplets. Now, that may sound complicated, but what the researchers found is that explosion alone into all of these little droplets is sufficient to account for the variety of raindrop sizes we see falling from clouds. So you don't need all these complicated interactions between raindrops smashing into each other. Single raindrops by themselves can essentially explode and give rise to all these shapes and sizes. And as you might imagine, the equations to describe that are still complicated, but far simpler than if you're dealing with, you know, millions of raindrops interacting with each other.
Well, how are those scientists who have been working on this more complicated model reacting to this?
Well, these scientists actually haven't been working on this more complicated model, but they would just put a lot more credence in this more complicated model. And they say that, you know, what they're seeing in this study, they don't feel like that replicates what's actually happening in real clouds. So the debate may not be settled just yet.
And the debate is happening because this is important for weather forecasting, or...
Well, that is a good question, Rob. What in the world are they doing this for in the first place? Is it important for weather forecasting, or could it improve our models of climate change? And it turns out it's not good for a whole lot. This type of research actually doesn't have a lot of real-world applications. As the main researcher said in the study, it's just for the pleasure of understanding.
So basic science.
Basic science.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy site, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into stories about reintroducing wolves into the Scottish Highlands and how that might help with conservation efforts in that area. And also a story about how the toucan uses its bill to keep cool. And on the science policy blog, Science Insider, we're looking into stories about the latest delay for CERN. This is the Large Hadron Collider, which has already suffered some setbacks and looks like it's suffering a few more. And we have a story on that. And also a story from Italy about the political fight to use embryonic stem cells in that country. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the July 24th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. Thanks to Stuart Wills for filling in while I was away. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.